Welcome to the Living Waters Church Podcast.
Welcome. If you don't know me, my name is Luke, and I'm on our pastoral team, and I have the privilege of opening the scriptures with you today. We've been in this series called Let There Be Light, and those words are the first words we actually hear from God in the biblical narrative. He speaks into the chaos with those words, and he brings out order and peace. He speaks into the darkness, and light emerges. And so when we say, let there be light, what we're really remembering is that God is the origin of light. And not just like physical light that we see, but like glory, his radiant glory. He's all-powerful, he's all-creative, and he radiates light. He brings light to wherever there is darkness. In the last couple of weeks, we've been exploring this theme as it relates to Christmas and the birth of Jesus. Doug started us off as we talked about the fact that an ancient light was predicted and on the way. At the very beginning of the biblical narrative, we hear that God is all about light. We see throughout the rest of the Old Testament that God is all about light. And then Jesus comes into the world, the light sent among us, to live amongst us, and this ancient light has been long planned, that God intends and has always intended to dispel darkness in the world and bring in light, to dispel death and to actually bring life. And so we started with that, with the reality that Jesus is from long past. He's from the very beginning of time, and he's amongst us now as we celebrate the Christmas season. And then last week, we got into the Christmas narrative in the Gospel of Luke, and Leanne led us to those passages where Mary and Joseph end up in Bethlehem, and Jesus is born. And then there's the shepherds in the fields, and angels come to announce that Jesus is born and says that you're invited, shepherds, to actually go to the manger and to see Jesus. And that's a nice, cuddly picture, and many people really don't have an accurate picture of shepherds. They think about shepherds as being sort of nice and cuddly and warm, but in fact, shepherds were on the outside of their society, both religiously and culturally. They were in the dark. And it's to those in darkness that the angels say, come and see the light. And so right at the very beginning of Jesus' life, people are gathering around him who come from the darkness, and they are drawn to him. They are drawn to the light. And so what we learn from that teaching is that God and his light through Jesus is for everybody. It's not just for the people that have their lives together, not just for the people who go to church, not just for the people who are squeaky clean, but God brings light to darkness. That's his whole point. That's why Jesus came. He came to a messy, dark place to bring light. And so all of us are welcome around that manger. And today we're continuing on into the series, and we're going to be moving from the Gospel of Luke over to the Gospel of Matthew. And in these two Gospels, we have a couple of different angles of the Christmas story. Matthew and Luke are telling the same story, but just from different angles. And so Matthew says this in Matthew chapter 2. If you have your Bibles, you can open there. And if not, it'll be on the screen for you. Matthew says this: Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. About that time, some wise men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem, asking, "Where is the newborn King of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him." So Luke tells us about the grungy shepherds, and then Matthew speaks to us about the opulent magi. Now, for some reason, I think that we're really interested and obsessed with the magi, or the wise men, as this translation calls them. There's something kind of compelling about them, I think, because they're mysterious. We don't really know an awful lot about them. And also, there's lots of tradition and lore around the magi that might be accurate, it might not be accurate. We're not really sure. We're not told an awful lot about them, but we love to think about them. I think they're actually my favorite characters in the Christmas story for a number of different reasons. But even if you look at nativity sets, some of them are missing shepherds altogether. The whole emphasis is just on baby Jesus and the wise men. For some reason, they're just so well connected, and they've been carried through our culture in that story. We don't really know an awful lot about them. We seem to think that there's three just in our heads, but that's probably only relating to the fact that they offered Jesus three gifts that we'll see later in the story: gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So there could have been two magi. There could have been 20 magi. We're not necessarily sure. All we're told is that they're from the east. They're from a distant land, and the east is a pretty big place. It's kind of broad, so there's not a lot of particular description for Matthew for us into where that is. There's a few ideas that scholars have, and their best idea is that they may have been from somewhere like Babylon. And that means that they probably had lived amongst a smaller Jewish settlement. They probably weren't Jewish necessarily themselves, but they were aware of the Jewish scriptures. They were aware of some of the Jewish prophecies and predictions. And they lived there, and we're told that they looked at the stars, and they learned from the stars what they believed was going to happen next in life. So they were astronomers. They studied the stars, but they were also astrologers. They're pagans. They're sort of reading the map of the stars, trying to figure out, trying to understand what's going on in the world based on what they saw in the sky, based on what they saw in creation. They were interested in what's going on. They were aware that there was more going on than just their material, regular lives. And so they were interested in what was bigger. And they were compelled by that. So we're told that they go on this journey. Now, I would like to go on a very particular journey. I've been thinking about it for the last year or so, and I'm hoping to go in the next couple of years. I was born in England, and we moved here when I was two. And we go back to England sometimes, but when we do, we visit family, and we stay in one very particular spot and spend time with them and just mostly drink tea for about 6 hours in the day. That's pretty much all we do. It's like, would you like a cup of tea? Yes, but can I have a cup of tea first? It's sort of like that's how much tea we drink. Like, it's so much all the time. Anyway, we just kind of hang out with family over there, and I would love to go back and explore more of where I'm from and get a sense of my roots and get a sense of, you know, bigger than just Fort Langley where I live right now. And I think that I'd like to do something that's a bit interesting that way. So one of the trips I've been looking at is actually going to the north of England and hiking along Hadrian's Wall. If you don't know what Hadrian's Wall is, it was a wall that was built by a Roman emperor about 120 AD, so 120 years after Jesus. This Roman emperor who had conquered Britain was basically dividing Britain up into two places. You know, there's the south that was governed. It was governed by the Romans, but in the north there was still barbarians or what they would believe to be savages. And so he built this wall to separate the two of them, and essentially that was a protection. Now, this wall has endured. You know, it's not totally like it was back in the second century, but there's still many parts of it that you can go and see. And in medieval times, they built into it and cities built around it. So it's this really interesting piece of history that sort of also goes through history as it goes through the British landscape. Because it goes from the second century all the way till now. It's still being developed and changed and shifted. So you can actually take tours and you can hike along this wall. And if you keep a good pace, you can do it from one end of England to the one side of England to the other in about 7 or 8 days. So one of the things I'd like to do is get a backpack and some friends or maybe some family from England and go and hike this wall. And I think that if I take that journey, that will kind of give me a broader perspective of where I'm from. It'll remind me again, like any journey that we take, that life is bigger than just this one place that we're at right now, that there is a before and there is an after, there is something broader going on, and whether you're taking a big journey like that, or you're hiking Everest, or even you're just walking around your neighborhood, a walk or a journey or a traveling mission that we take, a pilgrimage in a way, reminds us that there's more going on. And in a way, I think that's sort of what's going on with the Magi. They really didn't know exactly where they were headed, and they had a particular idea about where they were going and who they were going to see, and that idea wasn't necessarily even accurate, but they were still drawn to go on the journey. They were still compelled to go on the journey, to be a part of something bigger. They recognized that in the night sky, and so they moved on this journey. They went on this pilgrimage of light. They're led by this star. They're unsure of their destination. They're unsure of exactly who they're being drawn to. But they're on this pilgrimage of light. And so Isaiah 60, verse 3, is fulfilled. Something that was spoken by a prophet 700 years before Jesus. Isaiah wrote, "All nations will come to your light. Mighty kings will come to see your radiance." So we have these kind of humble, grungy shepherds who have been gathered. And in this story that Matthew tells, we have these outsiders, these aliens, these people from a different nation entirely being drawn to what God is doing in Bethlehem through Jesus. The story continues in Matthew 2 into verse 3. King Herod was deeply troubled when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of the religious law and asked, "Where is the Messiah supposed to be born?" "In Bethlehem in Judea," they said, "for this is what the prophet wrote. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah. A ruler will come from you who will be the shepherd for my people Israel." Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. Then he told them, "Go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child. When you find him, come back and tell me so I can go to worship him too." You know, in the cast of Christmas characters, sometimes Herod gets overlooked. And I was so thankful that Leanne taught clearly for us on who Herod was, you know, last week. Because, you know, Herod is sort of the dark side of Christmas in many ways. I was talking with a friend a while back, and we're talking about, you know, storytelling and movies and characters and the Bible, and she said something really interesting. She said, you know, we love to sanitize our stories. We love to sanitize our heroes, and we love to sanitize our stories. We like to make everything look beautiful and perfect, like a little nativity set that's just made of everything porcelain and white. But the reality is that the story is quite messy. The story does have a dark side, and Herod represents that dark side. And that dark side means that Herod walks in self-interest and in pride. And that actually affects the people around him in an extremely, extremely negative way. Actually brings death wherever he goes. So the Magi show up to Jerusalem because they think that if a king is born in this area where the star has appeared for them, then he's probably in the capital. And they go to Herod, who's the governor in Jerusalem, and they say, "So where's the king?" He says, "Well, there's no king here." And Herod is concerned with this. It says that Herod is deeply disturbed. Interesting that the one that we'll later call Prince of Peace is disturbing to Herod. Why? Herod doesn't want to be dethroned, does he? Herod wants to be the preparer. He wants to be the controller. He wants to be his own king, his own man. And we see this throughout all of his life. And so he really represents in this Christmas story, he represents everything that is pride, everything that is self-interest, everything that is negative, everything that sort of, in a way, makes our world dark. Not love or kindness or generosity or selflessness, but the opposite of those things. And so Herod hears of this. He's disturbed. The rest of Jerusalem, we're told, is disturbed as well, because if Herod's unhappy, everybody's going to be unhappy. That's the way it works. Is there somebody in your family like that at Christmas? And when they come over, "Oh, goodness gracious me, I sure hope this person is happy this Christmas." See, that's sort of what's like. It's sort of what it's like, but just a little worse, hopefully. Hopefully you don't have someone in your family like Herod. So he calls this meeting of the religious leaders, and Herod's not of Jewish descent himself, but he sort of adopted their religion to appease the people that he's ruling. And he calls them together. He says, "So where is this Messiah, this legend of this ruler or this Savior supposed to be born?" And they tell him, they point him to Micah 2, or Micah 5, 2, and Samuel 5, 2, and they say, "Well, he's supposed to be born in Bethlehem." So Herod kind of hatches this plan. And he says, "Well, why don't you, wise men, go and find him, and when you do, come and tell him so I can come and worship him." As we learn later in the story, that's not Herod's intention at all. He actually wants to murder this child. And so it's a bit of a trick that he's trying to play on them. What's interesting is that the people that Herod has amassed to actually tell him where this child is to be born don't seem to have all that much interest in going to see if the child has been born. We don't read that in the text at all. They had a pretty clear idea, actually, of where and when and how they thought this Messiah was supposed to be appear. And Jesus, as he was born in Bethlehem at that time, didn't really factor into that. So they had a perspective, they had a way, and Jesus wasn't involved in that at all. And so within this little story, we actually have three reactions to Jesus that are quite common throughout all of the Gospels. First reaction is indifference. Indifference, which is demonstrated by the leading priests and scribes of the time. People who have their own idea about how the world works, they have their own perspective, their own worldview, and Jesus doesn't really factor into it, so they're not really concerned with him necessarily. It's not necessarily negative, but it's just they're set, and they don't really seem to have him on their radar. That's a smaller portion of people, but there's a very, very small portion of people that are the next kind of heart action towards Jesus, and that would be this position of opposition. And that's represented by Herod. And there's really not, I don't think, a lot of people in our culture that are like this. 99.9% of people are not as adamant as Herod is in trying to hold on to everything. You know, there can be a little Herod in our hearts, as one of my professors used to say, but we're not necessarily completely overtaken with his attitude. But that is one reaction to Jesus. We have indifference, and we have complete and utter opposition, resistance, entire resistance. And then we have this third attitude, this third reaction to Jesus. And that's the attitude of the wise men. And that's simply interest. Interest. And they might not really exactly know who Jesus is. They might actually have a completely different idea about who he's going to be, but they're interested in being a part of something bigger, and they're willing to go on a journey. These are pilgrims. These are people who ask questions. These are people who aren't really sure about a lot of what's going on in the world around them, but they're willing to go on journeys, they're willing to ask questions, they're willing to get involved, even if they don't have all the puzzle pieces and it doesn't all totally line up. They're humble enough to do it. And I think that that's the large group of people that you and I associate with. People with questions, people who know that there's something more going on, they're not exactly sure where they'd be arriving as they gravitate towards Jesus, but somehow they're drawn by the stars or by friends or by somebody or some weird way that we might not even think that God would use, and yet they are somehow drawn to him. That's who the Magi are. That's who the wise men are. They are interested. And the compelling thing about this story, just like we see with the shepherds, is this: the interested people are often the least likely, we think, that God is interested in. God is interested in the lowly outcast shepherds. God is interested in the aliens, the people who are not in any way part of the story before, not in any way part of Jewish or Israelite history, and yet God draws all these people to himself through Jesus. The story continues in verse 9. After this interview, the wise men went their way, and the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were filled with joy. They entered the house and saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasure chests and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So a light guides their path. Again, we see this theme of light in the Christmas story, and they follow it. The heavens announce Jesus' arrival. The heavens proclaim it. Creation says that the Creator has come. It can't help it. They pick up on this, and they follow that way. Creation shouts it, and they show up, and they meet whom they describe to Herod as the king of the Jews. And that's the name that he's given at his birth. Ironically, it's also the name that is given him at his death, as it's nailed above his head on the cross that he hangs, the king of the Jews. Even more ironically is the fact that in this story, there's actually no Jewish people gathering around Jesus. The people who are supposed to be there, supposed to recognize him, really actually don't. It's people from distant lands that are there. So here they have come to worship this king of the Jews, not even their own king. They think he's a political power. They think he must be interesting because what's going on in the sky says that, and so they're drawn to him. They may not even really know his identity. In fact, I wager to bet they would have no idea who they're actually dealing with, yet they were still drawn, and they still want on a journey. And God seems to be okay with drawing them, even though they're not absolutely sure what the journey is they are on. There's some mystery involved in that. And God seems to be okay with that as well. The outsiders drawn from a distant land, they discover really in this moment that he's much more than the king of the Jews. He's actually the king of creation. He draws all people. They meet him. Matthew says they experience joy. And we don't know, because we're not told, if they meet him, if all of a sudden they realize he's not a political leader and he's actually God amongst them. We're not told that. We're just told that they pay homage to him, that they bring him gifts and they worship him because they know he's important, and then they kind of go on their way. But we are told that they experience joy, and I think that that is an important fact in the story. Because wherever we experience God's presence, we experience true joy. And that's what they experience. Wherever we truly encounter God, we experience joy. And that's why this Christmas season is absolutely 110% all about joy. Because where God's presence is, that's where joy is. And as Jesus has come to us and lives amongst us, we experience joy. The incarnation means joy. And that's what the wise men experience, even if they haven't got it all figured out at this point. Their pilgrimage is complete. And so they close with worship and with giving. They bow down to him and they give him gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which are super expensive gifts. And it's actually going to fund a little vacation that the family's going to take next. Not so much a vacation as they're fleeing from a murderer. But you get the idea. They're going. They have some traveling costs covered because of the gifts that they give. And so Isaiah 60, verse 3 is fulfilled. These kings have been drawn. A light has drawn them. The radiance of God has drawn them. Something has brought them. And they humble themselves. They humble themselves in front of a humble king. They humble themselves in front of a humble king. Lots of times we stop the story there. That's when the big Christmas production ends. Everyone's worshiping. The angel comes down from the ceiling. It's Doug Smith, and everyone's just super pumped about it. A couple of you remember that from a few years ago. And that's sort of where it ends, but the story kind of continues to go on, and we're going to stay with it until verse 12, and then we'll pause there. But when it was time to leave, Matthew says, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. So just as Joseph is warned to flee to Egypt with the family, they're warned by God to not go back to Herod, because he's got a nasty little plan that we're going to see in the next passages. If you continue to read on, you'll see what Herod does and how much his pride kills and is dangerous. So when we look at this, again, we see those three responses to Jesus. We see these three reactions to Jesus, this response of indifference, this response of opposition, and this response of interest. And the wise men have the response of interest. And so words spoken before Jesus was born by a wise king named Solomon, and then are later echoed after Jesus has lived by a man named James, says this: God gives grace to the humble, but opposes the proud. God gives grace to the humble, but opposes the proud. Consider this in the story. God actually works against Herod. He's on the opposite side. He's not on God's side. And so God ruins his Christmas. He foils his plan. He messes with his situation. He intercedes and does something about it. And you know what? We will always be opposed to God if all we're concerned about are ourselves, our own pride, our own way, being our own kings and queens and sitting on our own thrones and controlling our own lives. We'll always be opposed by God in that way, because that is a thing that kills. Pride kills. Instead, we need to allow our hearts to be like the hearts of these magi that journeyed to see Jesus. We need to realize that a life that God is involved in, a life that God breathes into, a life that we're welcome into, is a humble journey to recognizing who he is in light of what's going on around us. It's a humble journey. It's a humble journey. So the question that I have for us as we go into the season is, will we be on God's side of humility this Christmas? Or will we be opposed to him by pride and self-importance? There's going to be a lot of people that we interact with this Christmas season. And you know, it's going to be very easy to stand back in some pride because these people are very difficult to deal with. Some of them are neighbors, some of them are colleagues, some of them are friends. And we're going to be in parties, and we're going to have people over to our homes, and we're going to go into other people's homes, and it's going to be challenging. Let's just name it what it is. It's going to be challenging. But we have a choice as followers of Jesus to exemplify the baby in the manger, to act like these humble magi, and to actually arrive in humility and kindness and love and patience and service, or we can show up with pride and arrogance and hold people at an arm's length. Our encouragement as we reflect on these passages today is that we walk in the humility of the Christ child at Christmas as we interact with everybody around us. Because we never know who God is drawing and how he's doing it. We never know who God is drawing and how he's doing it. We'd hate for pride to get in the way of what he's doing. There's a young lady who turned 18, graduated high school. She lives in a different country. And she decides it's time to go to university. So she packs up all of her things and she says goodbye to her family and she moves to a town a few hours down the road. And she's never lived in another town before. She's never lived anywhere different before. And so it's all kind of new. It's kind of scary. She decides that English will be her major, so she starts studying the classics. And she begins to ask questions about the world and writes and learns and reads. And she meets friends in her dorm. Some of them are some really nice people, and one of them is this guy. And whenever she goes over and hangs out with her friends and this guy in their apartment, she sees that he's got books about Jesus lying around his place. And that kind of makes her ask a couple questions, and she learns actually that he is a full-on kind of practicing Christian. And she really seems like a nice person. They continue to hang out and go to parties and study together and stuff like that. And one day around Christmas time, he says, "Hey, do you want to come to a carol service at my church?" And she says, "Oh, sounds good." So they go to this carol service together, and she sings the carols and reflects on the birth of Jesus, which she doesn't know a lot about. She just knows a little bit about it from when she was a kid. And somebody gives her a book about Jesus, and she takes this book home, and she starts reading this book about Jesus, and she starts asking more questions about who Jesus might be. She's thankful for her friend who's there for her and is willing to answer any questions that she has. She gets the book of Luke and she reads through it. And she approaches it like she would any other piece of literature she works with. She writes questions. She underlines parts. And she starts to feel compelled by this story. She starts to feel compelled by this person of Jesus. She feels so compelled that she goes home that Christmas and she buys for herself a Bible as a Christmas present. And she reads the Gospel of John. And this feeling gets stronger. The questions get deeper. And she can't seem to shake the story. She can't seem to shake the person of Jesus. She continues to ask her friend into the new year as she goes back to school about Jesus, and they have conversations. And every now and then, she listens to a podcast of a little church in Canada, actually in Fort Langley, of her cousin who's a pastor there. And she listens to the sermons of the people, and she doesn't really know why, but whenever she hears the scriptures read and hears the teaching, she's somehow compelled and she's soothed. And she actually listens to them when she's homesick, even though she doesn't really know her cousin very well. Somehow she feels at home when she listens to the scriptures, when she listens to the teaching. She actually hears one teaching about forgiveness, and even though she's not following Jesus, she realizes that there's somebody in her life she hasn't forgiven, and it's eating away at her, and so she approaches this friend and says, "I extend you forgiveness," and walks in this journey and finds great peace and joy in that. She actually then one day stumbles upon a teaching of not from her cousin, but from a different pastor in the church who has cancer. And he begins talking about how he has cancer, but how he trusts God and how God is with him through that journey, even though it's very, very hard. And then he jumps into this message, which is called Embrace Grace. And most of the people who heard the message that day probably forgot it by the time they finished eating lunch. But she'll never forget that message because it was the first time that the penny really dropped for her on what the gospel really is, who Jesus really is, and that did something in her. the year continues to roll on. She continues to ask questions, so much so that one day she just talks to her friend and says, hey, can you take me to your church, please? And he says, yeah, sure. She's like, what's taking you so long to ask me to go to church with you? So she goes to church with him, and she experiences the services, sings the songs, hears the sermon, and as they're walking home back to the dorm, she says, I think that I'm a Christian now. She gets involved in the church. She gets involved in her Christian union. She begins telling other people about Jesus. She joins a small group. She's overflowing with joy and life. She knows Jesus now. She's been drawn. She really wasn't sure about the journey, but she was drawn over a period of about a year. She actually, just a couple of weeks ago, stood in the very same carol service that she did 1 year ago and sang songs that means so much more to her now because she knows the truth behind them, because she knows the person behind them. Now, a year ago, she didn't really know what this all was going to mean. She just said, I'll go to a carol service. A year ago, she really didn't know who Jesus was or what was going on, but she was drawn by it. She was compelled by it. And she had people around her, even people who weren't really aware they were impacting her, acting in humble, kind, gentle ways. They didn't get in the way of her journey, but they ushered her in towards the manger. And she wrote this week. Jesus wasn't who I was expecting, but he turned out to be everything that I wanted. And she humbled herself before a humble king. God draws everybody by his light. We have no idea who he's drawing or how he's drawing them. May we this Christmas be like that child who is humble. May we be a guide for them. May we be honest. May we be loving. May we be patient. May we be kind. May we show them who God is through our character. And if you're here today and you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, and yet somehow you feel like you've been on, maybe you wouldn't call it this, but you feel like you've been on a journey or a pilgrimage and you're not really sure who Jesus is, but you're compelled by it, I want to tell you to continue to be brave and continue to be humble. Continue to ask the questions, and Jesus will show you who he really is. That's what Christmas is about. It's about illumination. It's about clarity. It's about God showing us who he really is in the person of Jesus, God with us. Nick is going to come up, and we're going to close today by singing, O Come, Let Us Adore Him Again. So I encourage you as we sing to pray for the people you know that you'll be interacting with who don't know Jesus, who you know your voice and your actions say a lot to. And I encourage you to reflect on this humble king, to reflect on the joy that he brings, and to consider what God has for you to do in this Christmas season. What God has for you to learn in this Christmas season, whether you call yourself a Christian or you don't. So why don't we stand together and sing, O Come, Let Us Adore Him. Worship him like the Magi did. Worship him like creation does.
O come, let us adore him. O come, let us adore him. Oh, God.